Welcome back to Preaching, Preacher Presentation, a class on making and preaching sermons. We've been talking in these past sessions about how do you present your message in a memorable way, acknowledging the fact that people remember only 20% of what they hear. So how do we increase that percentage? And so we've been talking about that a little bit. Well, today I want to continue that theme. You'll notice the title on here is Use Visuals. Now, the sermon I remember best in my life happened because of the visual that a person used. It was a friend of mine, and we invited him. We had an evening service, and he was a missionary that we supported. Now, this was when I lived in Southern California, and so this was a man who was a friend of mine who was a missionary as an Anglo living in South Central LA, which is almost all, at that time, African American. And so he worked in a church there in a very difficult setting where he often had guns pointed at him, that sort of thing, as they tried to close crack houses and things like that. Well, we invited him to come and preach in one of our evening services. And he brought with him two visuals that were rather powerful. The one is one we've talked about earlier, as we showed you that video of the guy creating a visual by cracking one of these cheap clay pots. You can buy them for a couple of bucks somewhere, and sometimes you can get them a whole lot cheaper for that at a garage sale here in the United States. Well, he had one that was dirty, and it was yucky, and it was just kind of sat there. So he had that one, and then he had this absolutely beautiful vase. This isn't a picture of the vase he brought, but it's similar to what we were talking about, and he used those as a visual at one point in his message. Now, what the point he was making in the message at the beginning with this just simple clay pot was that God takes us as clay pots, right? We're clay pots. But sometimes we get dirty. We sin. We fail to live the way He wants us to live. We don't just sin by not obeying God, but we sin by disobeying Him. We sin by not living out the way He wants us to live as far as the goodness that we should be doing in the world. And sometimes, he said, the stench of our dirt and our filth go to God. And he gave the example of Sodom and Gomorrah, how the stench of Sodom and Gomorrah, we read, reached into heaven, so much so that God had determined to destroy those cities. And then there's that whole story in the book of Genesis about the angels coming to Abraham, and Abraham kind of bargaining with God about saving the city if there's, five righteous people. Would you destroy it if there are five righteous people in the city? And anyway, he says, so Lot gets rescued from the city, but God's judgment pours down and destroyed that city. And he put a towel over this gray pot, had a towel under it, he took a hammer out, and he smashed it to smithereens, and then opened it, and there it was. He says, that's what it's like to be under God's judgment. And then he took this beautiful vase, and he just told a story about this vase. He said this was a very valuable vase to him. He said, one, it was beautifully made, but it was given to him by a friend. And this was a friend that he had met when he was in Vietnam as a serviceman in Vietnam of the United States fighting there. And he said this friend and he just kind of clicked when they were first got in the same platoon together. But over a period of time, this friend had saved his life on at least one, maybe more occasions. And so they had this bond that lasted even after they got home back to the United States. There was this bond that lasted. And one time when they were going to meet once again and talk, this friend gave him this beautiful vase. He said, it looks similar to what they used to see in the marketplace when they were in Saigon and Vietnam. He said, and I give this to you just because I want you to think of me every time you see this beautiful vase. And then he talked about God's relationship within himself, about God's love of the Son, where he could say at Jesus' baptism, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. So this is my Son. Listen to him at the Transfiguration. That mystery of the Trinity of God, we talk about it being one God, but in three different persons. And that love that existed there. And then he said, but what did God choose to do with his beloved Son? And he wrapped this beautiful vase in a towel, just as he had the clay pot. And he said, he chose, because he loves you and he loves me, to send his judgment on his beloved son. And he raised the hammer, and there was something in me that just wanted to cry out, no, don't break it. And other people reported the same reaction. I said, I'm sure everybody who was in that service that night experienced that same kind of feeling as he raised the hammer and then smashed this beloved, valuable pot. I will never forget that message. Now today, we're going to talk about visuals, using visuals in your messages. And there's a question always, an argument, should you use visuals or not? Now there are a variety of arguments about why not to use visuals. Here's some of the better known ones. One, people will remember the visual, not the point. Yes, that can happen. It can happen that some people would think, oh yeah, I remember that visual, but what was that point again? That can happen. But, you know, I'd rather have people remember the visual, remember something, and maybe get a truth out of it than not remember anything. I'm going to tell you later about the pastor of my teen years. Another one is the change of senses. You know, going from the auditory sense to the visual sense might be distracting for people. Well, it might be. I don't know, and there are no studies that say so. And some people argue against using visuals like PowerPoint, saying, you know, PowerPoint and bullet points creates kind of a simple message. It simplifies things to a point of the ridiculous. Like, you know, you always end up with sermons that have 3 points, you know, 3 ways to save your marriage, 5 things you can do to grow more spiritually, or 10 ways to do this or that, that it reduces the wonderfully complex and yet beautiful message of the Scripture to bullet points, and so we shouldn't use them. Those are the main arguments that I'm aware of as far as the don't use visuals. But there are some big arguments for using visuals as well. For instance, God does it. God uses visuals. In fact, you can't read the Scripture very far where you become aware that visuals are important to Him. He uses visuals to communicate to His people. You see this throughout Scripture, but when you get to the prophets, it becomes almost an every page occurrence. I recently completed the book of Jeremiah in my devotions. And you know, how does Jeremiah start? Well, it starts with a call to being a prophet on the part of Jeremiah. When you read Jeremiah 1, you read that God calls him saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. And that's how he lives out his word. But in verse 11 of chapter 1, you get a picture of this call, of his message. It's a visual. We read here, verse 11, the word of the Lord came to me. What do you see, Jeremiah? In other words, there was a visual. I see the branch of an almond tree, I replied. The Lord said to me, you have seen correctly, for I am watching to see that my word is fulfilled. Now, to understand how the people would interpret that, how Jeremiah would interpret that, here's a theologian, a Bible commentator, reflecting on that passage. It said, in the first vision, Jeremiah saw an almond branch. The almond bush was the first to come to life in the spring. The blossoming of the pink flowers of the almond tree was a sure sign that spring was coming. The flowers come before the leaves. So the almond branch was a symbol of the coming fulfillment of the Lord's word. The Lord will carry out his word without delay. The period of waiting and warning was almost over. The time of judgment for Judah and Jerusalem had come. So that message came with a picture. And the picture affirmed the message. And so every time Jeremiah thought of the urgency of his message to God's people, he could think of that almond tree. Well, there's another marvelous picture later in Jeremiah where we have him getting direction from the Lord. Verse 8, chapter 18, this is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Go down to the potter's house. Oh, excuse me, there's the almond branch. Here's the potter's house. And there's a message there. So I went down to the potter's house, and I saw him working at the wheel, but the pot he was shaping from the clay was marred in his hand, so the potter formed it into another pot, shaping it as he seemed best to him. Here's a visual, right? A potter at work. Then the word of the Lord came to me. He said, can I not do with you, Israel, as this potter does, declares the Lord? Like clay in the hand of the potter, so are you in my hand, Israel. If at any time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be uprooted, torn down, and destroyed, and if that nation I warn repents of its evil, I will relent and not inflict on it the disaster I had planned. And if at another time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be built up and planted, and if it does evil in my sight and does not obey me, then I reconsider the good I had intended to do for it. Now, say this to the people of Jerusalem. It came with a visual aid. And so one of the arguments for it is this is the way God communicates to us. He communicates to us in pictures. He communicates us to it in these object lessons that are visual, that have to do with life. And certainly, you know, if God in the Old Testament does it, Jesus in the New Testament certainly uses visuals. You can't read the parables. You can't read some of the stories about Jesus without seeing him use the visual. One of my favorites is when Jesus takes this little child and puts him among them, that the disciples are talking about, you know, who's the greatest among them. And he takes a little child. Here's a visual lesson, an object lesson, different than illustration in some ways, but a visual illustration. And he said, unless you become like this little child, you will in no way enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, you know, what did Jesus intend with that? Well, probably many things that could be interpreted that way. It could be interpreted that he meant that they should become trusting like this child, or joyful like most children are. You know, there have been studies done about how often little children giggle and how we lose that as we move into adulthood. Maybe he was just saying approach the joy of life, but I suspect in the context it was the trusting character of children that says, I'm going to be a child, but I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to recognize that I'm not an adult. And so they would be able to turn more and more over to God. And so Jesus does this all the time. He says, look at the birds of the air. Visual. Birds of the air. Said, see how they don't sow, they don't reap, and yet they don't have barns to store up their stuff in, and yet your Father takes care of them. How much more important are you than the birds? Now, that comes in a context in Luke 12 where Jesus is talking to a man who called out as he was teaching, Lord, bid my brother divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus' response is, well, who made me a judge among you in that sense? And he says, first of all, beware of greed. And he recognized the greed in this man's heart. And so it becomes an object lesson to say, birds of the air, I've got to trust God. I can't just try to get ahead financially. The seed and the sower. How does the word get spread about? Grass in the field. All of these kinds of things he uses. So we have arguments for God does it, but church history shows that we've been doing this for a long, long time. For many, many years in churches, they would have stained glass windows, and those stained glass windows were visual lessons in a people where they were mostly illiterate. They used these pictures to teach people, and we still do that with children yet today. Only now we do that in more sophisticated ways. So we do this because you know, God does it, the church's history shows it, and today we are in a visual world. In the United States, there are 2.5 television sets per household, and they watch it 35.6 hours per week. Now, that has created us as people, though I think we're born that way, and certainly God has done it a long, long time, but we're born with a tendency to take in things more visually even than we are orally with me speaking to you. So it's important that you see me, not just hear me. Not that you can't learn things from just the audio. We're going to talk about that another time too. But we need to have visual stuff for our interpretation of things. So how do you do it? Well, movies, television clips, if you've got the capacity to do that, those can be powerful. There's this, in fact, here's an example. This is from Indiana Jones, and he has to get the chalice that Jesus supposedly drank at the Last Supper. And unless he gives to liquid to his father out of that chalice, his father is going to die, and so he has to go. But he sees between himself and the cave where the chalice is held that there's this huge chasm, and how will he ever get there? Well, he has to take a step of faith, and as he reads and reflects on the stuff, he's willing to take this step of faith, and all of a sudden there's a trail that appears before him. Something like that is a wonderful thing to talk about, taking a step faith. You can find all kinds of examples of these. Oh, I didn't say anything about copyright laws there. You must beware of using copyright laws. In other words, you can only use certain kinds of material and you can't use it for financial gain. So beware of that. But there are even services like SermonSpice.com where you can get visual video declarations of some kind or another, or skits, those kind of things that can illustrate your sermons. You can use common objects. A friend of mine just recently used this one of the lifesaver ring. When he talked about what Jesus does for us, and he threw it out into the audience and pulled it back with a rope to say, you know, he gives us, as we're being swept away by life, as we're being swept away by our own self and our own desires, we get this life ring, and there's a power that pulls us back to life. You can find it in all kinds of common objects. You can find it like a rope. You know, I saw one message where the guy used a rope that was encompassing the whole front of the church. And he walked from one end and said, that represents eternity past, that represents eternity future. And then he goes to the middle and he says, and here's your life right here. That's it. That's all you get. A rope. The gate. Powerful sermon on Jesus being the gate, as he claims in the Gospel of John, is one of the I Am statements. And this guy had built a small sheep pen on the stage, just roughly put together, and then there's the gate where the shepherd sat, so no thief or wild animal could get in without going past him. And so he sat there and gave his message, a large part of it, from there. And that became a visual, a gavel about judgment. You may wonder why this is here. This is one of my visual aids that I remember well. There was a time in my life where I felt a friend of mine had betrayed me. And I could not believe. It was a tough time in my life. I was going through some really difficult stuff. And then I felt like this man on whom I depended and with whom I had shared so much was now cutting off my legs in life. And so I was going to a counselor during this time. And I said, what do I do with this anger I feel? And he said, well, you've got to somehow externalize your anger. And so he says, find some way. He said, if you're a runner, run. Well, I had some knee problems at the time, so I couldn't run. So I determined, I got out my sledgehammer, and I just sat in the backyard, just pounding on the ground, pounding on the ground, pounding on the ground. The message that day was about forgiveness. How do you forgive someone? But for me, the visual was, yeah, we get that way. Several people said, yeah, I know what that's like. And then we talked about the importance of forgiveness. So you can do it in a variety of ways with very, very common objects. How do you do it? Well, movies, television clips, common objects. Get a team of creative people if you can. That's a marvelous thing. Use PowerPoint for punch. Now, I'm running out of time here for this session. And so I want to show you a video. It's a short video, but it just gives all the problems with PowerPoint. PowerPoint is a wonderful blessing, and if you're able to use that, if you have the technical capacity to use it, it can provide a great deal of good visual aid for your messages. But there are problems with it, and there's a rather humorous presentation embedded in this video, and when you watch that, you'll just see that, yeah, this is... there are some problems with PowerPoint too. So just be aware, and I'll see you next time.
So this is a thing I do called Life After Death by PowerPoint. Basically, don't do these things with PowerPoint. These are the things that people do that drive me nuts. And the only way to show them not to do this is to show them what not to do. So the biggest one I see, the most common PowerPoint thing, number one, people tend to put every word they're going to say on their PowerPoint slide. Although this eliminates the need to memorize your talk, ultimately makes your slides crowded, wordy, and boring. You lose your audience's attention before you even reach the bottom of your first slide. Second most common, font size is important. Size matters. Too small, and that's not good for anybody. On the other hand, too big, and you're looking more. You just look like an idiot. Don't have your fonts moving. Keep your text stationary. There's nothing more annoying than text that doesn't blinking. Don't have it blinking. Don't have it spinning. Don't have stuff flying around the screen. You drive people with ADD crazy. They're just like, oh, what's happening? Oh. Now, since I'm talking about fonts, people are really into fonts. I've noticed this. Here's one of the best jokes that I know. Comic Sans and Helvetica walk into a bar. And ask the bartender for a drink. And the bartender says, sorry, we don't serve your type here. That kills at a font convention. Oh, that's a good one. It's a type. I get it. The font you you choose, be very careful. Everybody has their favorite font. The font you choose sends a message about who you are as a person. There's a long list of fonts. We pick one. That reflects our personality. We're sending an unspoken message. So, for example, if you choose Carrier New, it means you're organized and structured. And like to pretend you're still using a typewriter. If you choose Comic Sans, it means you think you're funny. And if you choose Times New Roman, it means you're lazy, apathetic, and unimaginative, and you always use the default. If you choose Georgia, it means you speak with a southern accent. If you choose Ariel, it means you like the Little Mermaid. Oh, a lot of Ariel people. If you choose Old English, it means you enjoy malt liquor. You can know this. We got a few more. Helvetica, that means you're a mayonnaise lover. That's a stretch. I'll admit that is a stretch. Black Adder, that means you're an African American accountant. That one requires some thought. Sorry. And if you like Wingdings, it means you're a nerd and you have no life. Now, if you type in all small letters, some people do that, all small letters, that means you're quiet, shy, and unassertive. If you type in all capital letters, that means you yell a lot. There's somebody over there. If you type a small letter followed by capital letters, it means your cap lock is stopped on. Don't you hate when that happens? You're usually going along for a while, you look up, oh, darn! And then finally, you've got a mix of capital letters and small letters. That means this is a ransom note and you are a kidnapper. Very hard to do, by the way. The fourth most common problem is avoid excessive bullet pointing, only bullet key points. Too many bullet points and your key messages will not stand out. In fact, the term bullet point comes from people firing guns at annoying presenters. This slide, by the way, has crashed PowerPoint. Apparently, there's a max about how many bullet points you can have, and I said, I pressed it. The other thing you can do is have animations. People love animations. They have stuff going zooming in and out and left and right. You get seasick watching some of these. And turns out if you're a visual learner, your effectiveness as a speaker will go up with the more animations. But if they're easily distracted, they are not even paying attention to what you're saying. They're just watching the cool stuff. And there's regions to this graph. There's the simple but effective region, the active but confusing, the effective but boring, the active but ineffective, the dull but static region, the busy but useless region over there, the ADD-only region there up in the corner, the useful musing, the stupid confusing, the dull triangle, the hyper triangle, the sleepy square, the dizzying pentagon, and then everything else is just grouped into what's called pointless motion. This one slide, by the way, took me 3.5 weeks to make. True, PowerPoint can suck the life out of you. Now, one of the biggest dangers today, and I'm telling you, I hear it more and more every time I hear a conversation, is what I call SAOD, or Severe Acronym Overload Disorder. Have you heard people talk recently? There are no words going between, yeah, I am'd my CFO about our ROI and our CRM and our RFP, and it turns out our EPS is really SOL, so we better do something ASAP. Like, can I buy a vowel? I can't solve your conversation. And I made up this resume, but this could be a real resume in today's world. Look, I got an MBA from USC, an MSEE from MIT, a BSEE from DU. I worked at IBM, HP, VLS. I remember IEEE, EIT, NCAA, NAACP, AARP, AAAA. I want a position as CEO, COO, CFO, CIO, CTO, CMO, CSO, CPO, CYO, VP, EPP, or EIEIO. I want to be the EIEIO of a company someday. That's actually my dream. Hi, I'm the EIEIO. Nice to meet you. Call me old McDonald, that's all right. Now, kind of my final point, and this people do all the time, they'll just have graph after graph just to impress you with their graph prowess. And I chose acronym usage. This is my real-time acronym usage. It pretty much goes up and down. I don't know why you'd need the graph, but you can see pretty much peak there. I'll use some more acronyms later. And there's just a chart that doesn't make any sense to you, but I just want to impress you. Here's an acronym letter distribution. C's, I's, E's, N's, and S's are the most common letters that I use in my acronym. Here's a pie chart letter distribution. I have no idea what you'd use that for, but... You can generate that automatically in PowerPoint. So I figured what the heck I did. Here's a line graph, the number of line graphs throughout my show. Here's a bar chart, number of bar charts. Pretty much goes up and down. Here's a real bar chart. There's beer, wine, martini. That's the kind of bar chart I'm into. Here's a candy bar chart. Here's a salad bar chart, tomatoes, sprouts, spinach, and the different calories of each. Here's a sushi bar chart. This is a probability of illness, depending on the favorite. There's a lot of detail in my act. Please pay close attention. Here's a bar chart of the number of bars visited versus age throughout my life. Most people don't take the time to do this, but you can see when I was 17, I had the fake ID, so it was confiscated when I was 19, and my bar usage dropped dramatically. I spend way too long making these charts. When I was 21, I went nearly every day of the year. You can see it was about 342. It's kind of gone down through the years. I plan to drink a lot when I'm 40, a lot when I'm 50, and then retire and drink constantly. That's my plan. Thank you. Here's a spreadsheet of spreadsheets. Getting back to the charts. Here's a spreadsheet of spreads. Butter, margarine, I can't believe it's not butter. Mayonnaise, French onion, cheese whiz, and Patriots plus five over Colts. Every possible spread you could imagine. Here's an org chart of org charts. There's my main org chart, my sales, marketing, engineering org chart. Here's your reorg chart. Every company should have those. And then this is interesting. This is my actual family org chart. Make one of these. It's important. Steve, our cat, runs our family. If you have a cat, you know that is true. Any animal that goes, hey, I just pooped in there, somebody clean that up. Clearly head of the family. My wife, Laura, reports to Steve. I report to my wife, and the remote control reports to me. That's it. That's my entire region of domain right there. Back to the charts again. Here's a pie chart of chart types, 3D charts, bar charts, pie charts. Here's a pie chart of pies for dessert, lemon, pumpkin, cherry, pecan, apple. Here's a pizza pie chart. Here's your pot pie chart. There's a better pot pie chart. Here's a pie chart with values of pi for the nerds out there. You got 3.14159, 22.7, 3.14, and pi itself. We have a pie chart. I was thinking, why don't we have a cake chart? So there's a cake chart. Why do we leave the cake out? There's a birthday cake chart. There's a wedding cake chart. There's a bundt cake chart, an upside-down cake chart, and then really that's an upside-down cake chart. And all right, I think I've covered all the charts. Any questions at this point?